This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is comic Tig Notaro. In August, she was diagnosed with cancer in both breasts. That's enough to put anyone's life on hold, but right after the diagnosis, she decided to show up for her regular comedy night at the Club Largo in L.A. She threw out her old material and did a set about her diagnosis, as well as several other recent tragedies in her life, including the death of her mother, the breakup of a relationship, and a severe bacterial infection. Louis C.K. also performed there that night and tweeted that her set was one of the greatest he'd ever seen, calling it masterful. Later he'll tell us what it was like watching the set. He's just made a recording of it available for purchase on his website. Terry recorded her interview with Tig Notaro October 2nd and began with an excerpt from the beginning of her set at Club Largo.
Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi. How are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? It's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer. God. Oh my God. It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy right now. That's just where I am in the equation. Oh, it's fine. Here's what happened. It's very personal. Found a lump. Guys, relax, everything's fine. I have cancer.
Tig Notaro, welcome to Fresh Air. And first, how are you?
I'm doing great. Almost better than ever.
What's your prognosis now?
My prognosis is great. I had a double mastectomy. They got all the cancer, and it did not spread like they had feared. I spoke with my doctor, who told me the testing came back, and I have a 7% recurrence rate. So that's beyond amazing.
That's wonderful. So I'm really happy for you.
Thank you. I am too. I'm thrilled.
So I'm so sorry that this has been such a rough patch of your life, but I'm so grateful that you've managed to make something so remarkable from all the horrors that you were going through. So let's start by talking about this set. If I were in the audience, when you walked out and did this whole, hello, good evening, I have cancer, I don't know that I would have had any idea how to interpret that, whether I would have thought you were serious or whether I would have thought, like, this is some really weird, like, performance art piece. And I keep thinking, like, who are those people who are laughing? They're saying, I have cancer. So how did you get the idea of starting that way?
Well, I originally was picturing myself being kind of that comedian for the night where I pull up a stool and I say, hey, you know, it's been a rough few months. Bear with me. I'm working on some material that's a bit of a detour from my regular stuff. And then I was taking a shower about an hour and a half before the show, and I was thinking, I can't do that. That's so lame. And I don't want to make excuses for my show before I get started, regardless of what I'm doing on stage. And my brain just popped out with this idea that I walk on stage and say, thank you. I have cancer. Thanks for coming. And it just made me laugh so hard just in the shower. And then I was thinking, oh, gosh, even though that's funny to me, I was scared of offending people and confusing people and, you know, thinking about people that maybe did have cancer in the audience or had somebody that they loved that had cancer. And then the reality hit me that I have cancer. Like, this is my, this is my story. And I just kept thinking about it and picturing it, and it just kept making me laugh so hard. And so I just decided to do it. I was really nervous, though.
So what was it like when you walked on stage and you did that whole, good evening, I have cancer, and people laughed? I think other people were just astonished and shocked. But everybody, I think everybody was completely with you, no matter what their reaction was. What were you feeling at that moment?
I was very nervous. I was rattled, and I felt raw, and I felt very vulnerable. Even though I had been diagnosed maybe a week prior to that, it was only maybe the day before the show that I had met with my doctor, who told me that I had stage 2 breast cancer and that the tumor on the left side was invasive, and that because the cancer was not contained, their fear was that it had possibly spread to my lymph nodes, and so they didn't know where the cancer had spread or if it had or how far. Like, they just didn't know. And I was just in a very vulnerable, raw place, and I had no idea what was in front of me. It was really just taking blind steps.
I want to play another excerpt of your set. And this was recorded in August, just a few days after you were diagnosed with cancer. And it's not just the cancer that you were dealing with, but also a few weeks before the cancer, actually more like maybe 3 months before the cancer diagnosis, you'd gotten pneumonia. And then as a result of that, you got an infection called C. diff, short for C. difficile, which is a kind of deadly bacterial infection that wreaks havoc with your whole digestive system. And then your relationship with your girlfriend fell apart. So you had all these things, terrible things happening to you. At the same time, your career was actually going very well at that point. So at this point in your set, in which you're talking about all these things that have happened to you, you've been talking about the good and the bad happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And how this is changing you.
Again, just please bear with me. It's so hard because, like, right now in my life, I don't feel like, when I have a show, I don't feel like, oh, I want to go talk about how funny it is that a bee was taking the 405 freeway. Like all the jokes that I've written, I just am like, I can't even bring myself to talk about it. Because, and here, just everyone relax, my mother just died. Should I leave? My mother just died, but tragically, too. She was 65, she tripped, hit her head, and died. A week after I got out of the hospital. I can't believe you're taking this so hard. You didn't know her. You didn't know her. I'm doing okay. What happened was, after we buried her in our hometown in Mississippi, we drove back to Texas, and I was checking the mail, and the hospital sent my mother a questionnaire to see how her stay at the hospital went. Not great.
That's Tig Notaro, and this set was recorded and is being released and has been released exclusively on Louis C.K.'s website. So, Tig, you know, when I was listening to this set for the first time, I think I really didn't know how to react. And I was, like, laughing and then thinking, like, this is not really funny. This is really tragic. It's horrible. I shouldn't be laughing. But then I was thinking, no, but she's saying it. What she's saying isn't funny, but the way she's saying it is very funny. And she's a comic. She'd probably prefer it if I laugh. And I was so almost distracted having this internal debate with myself about whether it was appropriate. I was listening alone in my car, you know, and laughing and having this debate with myself. And then I'm listening to the audience respond on this recording, and some people are laughing and some people are shushing the people who are laughing. And then you also hear, you can kind of like hear the silence of some people.
Yeah.
What response made you feel best during, as you know, as the set kept going and people are kind of getting more and more attuned to where you're heading?
Yeah, it was a lot to take in. You know, I feel like the 300 people that were in that audience that night were the exact perfect people that should have been there. They were just so tremendous. And, you know, there's just so many different reactions. It was the first time in my career where I've looked in the audience and seen people crying. And there was a point where I wasn't sure if things had gotten too dark, and I had considered and suggested that maybe I just call it a night. And this guy, you know, he spoke up, absolutely not, and the crowd just burst into this supportive, I don't even know, it was so emotional. I almost started crying.
Really?
It was, and I just thought, oh, please don't cry. Just, you can't walk out here and tell them all this stuff and then start crying on stage. You know, I just would have felt so defeated. But I wanted to feel and seem strong, and I had to pull myself together before I spoke again.
Well, I want to play another excerpt of your set at Largo. And so at this part in your set, you're talking about how you were trying to, like, one night you were just so depressed, you were trying to drown your troubles with food, but the problem was, because of still recovering from the C. diff, there's very little that you could eat, so, like, you were binging on Triscuits, because they're basically, like, wheat flour and water. And so
it's rock bottom.
Yes, rock bottom, absolutely. So this is that part of the set.
I was trying to drown my emotions in something. That's all I could do. Like, that's it. I'm going to the store and I'm buying Triscuits. It's like through all of this, like getting diagnosed, like, oh, I'll call my girlfriend. Oh, we broke up. Oh, I'll call my mother. Oh, my mother died. Oh, I'll go buy some food. Oh, I can't eat anything. Guys. Who here is just wishing I would tell bees going down the 405. I just can't. I'm sorry. But you know what's nice about all of this is that you can always rest assured that God never gives you more than you can handle. Never. Never. When you've had it, God goes, all right, that's it. I just keep picturing God going, you know what? I think she can take a little more. And then the angels are standing back going, God, what are you doing? You are out of your mind. And God was like, no, no, no. I really think she can handle this. But why, God? Like, why? Why? No, I just, you know, just trust me on this. She can handle this.
Did finding comedy within the tragedy help you get through it? Or did it at least make you feel like, well, I'm good professionally. Like, I know how to make this work on stage. I'm good at that. What did you get from the performance?
I got so many different things on so many different levels at so many different times. It was just the bursting at the seams, cathartic moment on stage of just being held up by this sold-out theater. And then I went to bed that night, and I'm not on Twitter and I don't follow blogs. And I woke up the next day and my phone, when I turned it on, just kept beeping, just so many voicemails and text messages. And I didn't understand how the whole world knew I had cancer. I was so confused. And then to go from the 300 people that night to you know, the world knew. And I've just been lifted and carried and supported, and I have amazing friends and family. And my first thought when I was diagnosed was, oh, I have to keep this a secret. I don't want to lose work. And then that just blew the roof off of that.
Good point.
Yeah, there was no, it was just so funny because I was talking to my manager just days before, like, how are we going to keep this a secret? You know, I'm going to be going through chemo. I'll be bald, 4 pounds. You know, this is clearly something's going to be suspicious. So next thing I know, everybody's like, oh, everybody knew I had cancer.
Well, and everybody wanted you. You got a book deal. You got like all kind. Yeah. All these invitations were coming in. You know.
Well, the day I was having my surgery, there was a bidding war on my book. It was such funny timing to be lying there.
Did you come out of the anesthesia and say, "So what did I get for it?"
Well, I mean, essentially, I woke up and I had the update of all the different offers that had come in, but it wasn't until I think the following day that the deal was secured. But it was such funny timing when my agent called and said, "Okay, so we're setting up the auction on the 4th, September 4th," and I was like, "Oh my God, I'm gonna be completely unconscious and under the knife." And he was like, "Oh my gosh!" Like it was just such outrageous timing.
So the set is now offered on Louis C.K.'s website. He was there that night, and I think he was your guest. Is that?
Yes, that on that show it was Mary Lynn Rice Cub, Ed Helms, Bill Burr. They were all announced guests. And then Louis C.K. was my surprise guest that was going to come on last and close the show, which...
Well, the surprise guest means you brought him as the surprise?
Yes. I knew he was my surprise guest. Okay. And the whole show was just fantastic start to finish. And but I was, you know, of course, concerned about my segment because it was my show and people had paid $25 or $30 for the show. And... aside from me, just the other people on the show could have handled picking up the pieces if things had gone wrong. But, you know, I just, in the back of my mind, I thought, well, I know I have Louis C.K. to come out and just slam dunk this entire situation.
But so he came on after you. I would not have won.
No, actually, Bill Burr went on after me, and he destroyed the room. He just... when I was walking off stage and he was walking on stage, he was shaking my hand saying, "I'm supposed to follow that? I'm supposed
to..." Yeah, no, exactly. I was just feeling bad for whoever had to follow you.
It was Bill Burr, and he's such a phenomenal stand-up comic, and it was just no problem for him. And then Louis went on after Bill, and again, no problem for Louis. It just, everybody had... phenomenal sets that night. It was really special and powerful in so many different ways.
So I'm wondering if this has like permanently changed your comedy in the sense that, you know, like you referred to this in your set, that a lot of your comedy before was along the lines of how you were sitting in, you know, stuck in traffic on the freeway and a bee was flying faster than your car was going. Mm-hmm. And what was a bee doing on the freeway and so on. But, I mean, it wasn't as...
That's a good joke.
Yes, I'm sorry, I kill jokes. I mean, I don't mean I kill in the good sense. I mean destroy in the bad sense.
I would like to do something where you do all of my jokes.
That's right.
And that'll be my next CD. Terry Gross does Tig Notaro.
Terry Gross kills in the bad sense. would... That would be a laugh riot. But anyways.
Terry Gross, Dead.
Dead.
That would be the album.
Yes, because Tig's okay. album is called Tig Notaro, Live. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But your stand-up really wasn't that personal, at least the stuff that I heard, where it would really, like, cutting personal
mm-hmm.
in the way that, you know, talking about cancer and illness and, you know, your mother's death is. So has this opened up like a whole new willingness to open yourself up to what you talk about?
Absolutely. I mean, I have no idea what's coming. I mean, obviously, my my 4 months of hell has proven that. But I still, I've been writing, and when I sit down at my computer, I was sitting on my couch last night and just writing, and I went back and looked at it, and it didn't even occur to me while I was writing. But when I went back and looked, I was like, wow, this is not about a bee passing my car on the freeway in 5 o'clock traffic.
I told that better than you did, I think, honestly, but you know, let the listeners judge, but yeah.
Come on, I've been through so much. Are you really going to take my comedy career away from me?
I might, yeah.
So yeah, I have no idea. I'm so interested to see what this has done to me. And I do know that what I feel lucky for and what has prepared me for now is that throughout my comedy career, I have evolved and changed. And what I think has been important, not just in comedy, but in life is, and it's so cliche, but really to take your own advice. And that's what I've done in my stand-up. And it has helped me because I started out a dry, deadpan, one-liner comic that didn't smile on stage. And I have allowed myself, by taking my own advice, to write longer jokes, And then I have this thing that I did on Conan where I pushed a stool around on stage for a couple of minutes. And that's not something I typically would have done. And going on stage to talk about my cancer and my mother's death, that's not something I would normally do. But if any of my peers would have said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, should I? I would never say, no, don't. That's not your thing. That's not your style, you know? So I'm very curious and I have no idea. All I know is that I'm going to do whatever makes me feel comfortable, and I'm going to do whatever I want to do and hope that the essence of me and what people liked about me in the beginning will come through.
Well, Tig Notaro, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations on your great prognosis. It's just wonderful news.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited, and thanks so much for having me on.
My pleasure.
Tig Notaro speaking with Terry Gross. Notaro's comedy set at Club Largo in L.A. last August is available for purchase on comic Louis C.K.'s website. He was there as a friend and a performer that night and got the word out when he tweeted this. In 27 years doing this, I've seen a handful of truly great, masterful stand-up sets. One was Tig Notaro last night. Terry spoke with Louis C.K., who's currently on tour, shortly after she spoke to Tig Notaro.
Louis C.K., welcome to Fresh Air. I know you're on the road now. Thanks for taking some time out with us. First of all, congratulations on your Emmys. That's really wonderful.
Thank you. That was very fun.
Yeah. So let's talk about Tig's set. Did you already know that she had cancer before you heard the set?
No, I didn't know. Well, I knew, like, 60 seconds before. But Tig had been sick before.
The C. diff infection, C. difficile infection.
That's right. And I knew about that. I hadn't seen her during that, but I knew because we have a lot of mutual friends who were taking care of her. And so when I called to ask if I could perform at Largo that night, Flanagan, the guy who runs it, said, actually, Tig's sick and she could use the help. Like, she could use somebody to come in and close out for her. So I thought, geez, she's still sick, you know. But I assumed it was the C. diff thing. So I went in and there was Tig, and we're standing in the dark next to the stage, and she's getting ready to go on. And I said, hey, I heard you're sick. I'm sorry. And she said, actually, I have cancer. And I was like, what? And she said, yeah, it's really bad, and it's in my whole chest, and it's going to go to like my lymph nodes, and I'm not going to make it probably. And she started telling me this stuff, and, you know, my eyes filled up. I couldn't believe it. And she said, I'm going to go talk about it on stage. And she had this handful of paper. And it was a lot to learn all at once, you know. And then she went on stage, and I stood on the wings of the stage and watched the whole set.
Okay, so she comes out and she says, and no one in the audience knows about the cancer, and she comes out. She comes out and she does the whole, you know, good evening, thank you, I have cancer, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What was your reaction to the audience's reaction? I had asked Tig this question, because when she starts doing this whole good evening, I have cancer, like, some people are just, like, in shock, and they're kind of gasping, but other people, like, they're laughing like this is just a regular set. And I know some people are laughing probably because this is so horrifying, they're laughing out of, you know, nervousness and, you know, just not knowing how to respond. But some people, you get the feeling like, it's a comedy club, yeah, ha.
Yes, that was the most interesting thing, was how many different reactions were going on in there. There was a woman in the front row who burst into tears, really visibly. And Tig went out into the audience. This is really early in the set.
I didn't know that.
And she said, ma'am, it's okay. It's okay. You're going to be okay. I'm not, but you're going to be okay. And everybody was, it was like somebody had you in a bus and they were jerking the like a joystick forward and back and side to side, because everybody was doing the same thing. She would say these things and you'd explode in laughter, and then you'd realize what it was about and you would gasp and it would choke you back and you'd cry, and then you'd just listen riveted, laugh, cry. It just was, she had the audience in a really startling amount of control, and I don't think she knew how she was going to do it. She was running by instinct. And the people in the audience, some of them knew her personally. Some of them, there was a really interesting spectrum there. Some people were big fans that just think she's really funny. And some people were just, you know, casual comedy fans.
One of the reasons why this performance got such a huge reaction outside of the people who were there was because of your tweet, the tweet where you wrote, in 27 years doing this, I've seen a handful of truly great, masterful stand-up sets. One was Tig Notaro's last night at Largo.
Mm-hmm.
From a comic's perspective, what made the set so good?
Well, Tig is a really great comic. She has a great sound. You know, for comedians, you see everything. We know all the tricks, so it's hard to impress a comedian with comedy. But some people have a sound that's just theirs, that's patented. It's kind of like horn players. There's probably times that Charlie Parker would tell John Coltrane, you know, I saw this guy in Chicago, you got to hear him. I mean, nobody's doing what this guy's doing. Tig has this really beautiful sound on stage. She has this way of dropping her jokes that are wonderful, deadly jokes. And they're about small things, usually, like bees and drapes. But they're incredible. So here she is applying it to something really big. And it was like an example of what comedy can do, which is taking people to the scary parts of their mind and making them laugh in those scary places. That's a great gift. And some of us do it through calculation or through repetition and kind of like, you know, focusing on a bit and refining it. Tig just went up there with her voice, and in front of us, she processed her own death with humor, with comedy, which is this very pure, oxygen-rich environment. You know, she did something about looking at a picture of herself when she was 5 and saying to this cute little picture, "You're going to get cancer." And we're all going, "Oh, my God." And I was crying and laughing the whole time. A lot of it was just me connecting with what she was saying, but to be right next to her, I was like, you know, 8 feet away, right on the side of the stage behind a curtain, and hearing the audience lurching back and forth, exploding, then hushed, totally hushed, and then exploding again. I had never saw anything like it, the way that she controlled it.
Louis C.K. speaking with Terry Gross from The Road. He's on tour with his latest stand-up show. Earlier, we heard from comic Tig Notaro. Louis C.K. released a recording of her stand-up set from Club Largo on his website. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Nate Silver, is a statistical analyst who's become something of a celebrity for his ability to plumb the meaning of opinion polls and other political data. He writes a blog called 538, named for the number of votes in the Electoral College. In 2008, he correctly called all 35 Senate races and the winners of presidential contests in 49 of 50 states. 2 years ago, his blog moved to the New York Times website, where it's closely followed by political junkies. Before he focused on elections, Silver developed a sophisticated system for analyzing baseball players' potential and became a skilled poker player, making his living from the game for a while. Nate Silver's written a new book about the explosion of data available to us in the Internet age and the challenge of sorting through it and making wise decisions. Silver looks at analysts in many fields, from economics to weather to national security, and concludes those who succeed at spotting new trends and understanding the future are careful to acknowledge what they don't know and examine the assumptions that underlie their thinking. Humility, he says, is critical. Silver's new book is called The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. Well, Nate Silver, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you tell an interesting story in this book about the relationship between all of the information we're getting nowadays and our inability to use it effectively.
Sure.
How much more data do we generate today than we used to?
So according to IBM, 90% of the data in the world was created within the last 2 years. Now, not all that data is very useful, though. It might include YouTube videos of people's cats and text messages sent between teenage girls. So the question is, two questions, really. Number one.
You're saying that's not important.
It might be, but if you have a very literal-minded way of looking at what is data, what is information, that stuff's encoded and beamed into outer space and will survive forever. But there's not a lot of knowledge in there. So,
right.
So one problem is that what we would call the signal-to-noise ratio, the amount of meaningful information relative to the overall amount of information, is declining. We're not that much smarter than we used to be, even though we have much more information. And that means the real skill now is learning how to pick out the useful information from all this noise, as we call it. The second thing people can do, though, when they have so much choice of what to read or which news outlets to learn about the election from, for example, is that people are often very selective about the information that they choose to emphasize. If you have three polls coming out every day, you can kind of handle those mentally and look at all of them. If you have 20, what happens is that people tend to pick three that they like, depending on if they're a Romney or an Obama supporter, and ignore the others. And so there are actually cases where, for some types of people, more information can make their analysis worse.
Now, we're in a situation today where we have not only far more data generated than ever before, but we also share it more easily because of the Internet. You compare this to the invention of the printing press. How are they similar?
Well, so the printing press, basically books were a luxury item before the printing press, where they cost the equivalent in today's dollars of about $25,000 to produce a manuscript. So unless you were a king or a bishop or something, you probably had never really read a book. And then all of a sudden, the printing press reduced the cost of publishing a book by about 500 times. And so everyone who was literate, at least, could read. But what happened is that people used those books as a way to proselytize and to spread heretical ideas, some of which are popular now, but at the time caused a lot of conflict. The Protestant Reformation had a lot to do with the printing press, where Martin Luther's theses were reproduced about 250,000 times. And so you had widespread dissemination of ideas that hadn't circulated in the mainstream before. And look, when something's on the page or on the Internet, people tend to believe it a lot more. And so you had disagreements that wound up playing into greater sectarianism and even warfare. The first 200 years or so after the printing press was invented were maybe the bloodiest epoch in the history of Western Europe.
And so are we in for a period of intensified conflict because we're sharing all this information?
You know, I don't think we'll have another repeat of the Crusades, but we have seen, for example, in Congress that the amount of partisanship has increased quite a bit. And you can time that back kind of to the dawn of the computer age and, frankly, also the growth in cable news. Right about when cable news comes online, you see this uptick in the graph where fewer and fewer times are Democrats and Republicans voting together and they're becoming more entrenched in their conservative or liberal views. So we are moving toward a time where there's greater disagreement instead of greater consensus. And that could have consequences. It could mean that we cycle back and forth between some very liberal presidents, some very conservative ones. Potentially, there's a lot of turnover. We've had periods like this in the country before, but it can be somewhat damaging. It can be damaging economically, frankly, as well, where you saw the debt ceiling debate really did have economic consequences. It kind of left that Washington bubble in ways that wound up hurting ordinary people.
Now, you write in the book that our challenge is to make sense of all this data, to put it in context. And if there's a glaring example of people having a lot of data and reading it wrong, it's, you know, Wall Street analysts and government regulators who failed to recognize the risks of what was going on in, you know, mortgage-backed securities and all of the derivatives that flowed from them before the economic crash. What was wrong with their approach?
So this is an example. It's a two-part problem. Number one is that you have these financial instruments called mortgage-backed securities that were new and complicated and that people didn't have good models for how to handle. The other problem is that the group that was charged with rating these, the rating agencies, were corrupt. They had a lot of skin in the game where every time a new mortgage-backed security was created, they would get profits by rating it. And so they had an incentive to give favorable ratings so that they could create more of these and make more of a commission. So those two things, when the person who was supposed to be kind of the lifeguard wound up being in on the scheme, created a disaster for the global economy.
So their analysis of data was tainted by bias?
Yeah, I think, look, one thing we talk about in the book is that you can build a statistical model and that's all well and good. But if you're dealing with a new type of financial instrument, for example, or a new type of situation, then the choices you're making are pretty arbitrary in a lot of respects. You have a lot of choices when you're designing the model about what assumptions to make. For example, the rating agencies assumed, basically, that housing prices would behave as they had over the previous two decades, during which time there had always been steady or rising housing prices. They could have looked, for example, at what happened during the Japanese real estate bubble, where you had a big crash and having diversified apartments all over Tokyo would not have helped you with that when everything was sinking. So they made some very optimistic assumptions that, not coincidentally, happened to help them give these securities better ratings and make more money.
Right. Now, in this book, about eight chapters in, you introduce us to an 18th century minister named Thomas Bayes, who had a real insight into how you look at data, statistical probability, all those years ago. What was his insight?
So it's called Bayes' theorem, and what Bayes' theorem is just a mathematical rule of how to weigh new evidence given what you already know. And probably the mathematical abstraction of it is less important than just the practical application, which means that you shouldn't take each piece of evidence in isolate. You should say, here's what I know, and how much should this change what I know? And ideally, in fact, you create a set of rules where before you encounter new evidence, you have an idea of how you would weigh it, conditional upon different things being true. One example we give in the book is, by the way, a lot of this Bayes' theorem stuff is actually very intuitive. It's kind of how we think naturally a lot of the time. If you're in a relationship and you encounter, say, a strange pair of underwear in your dresser drawer, which could potentially be a sign of infidelity, the right way to look at that information is to consider it in context of the relationship you have already. It might be very damning if you've already had reasons to suspect that your partner is cheating. But if you've been in a relationship for 20 years or something, this person is honest as can be, then you wouldn't weigh it very heavily. And that's all it is. It's just saying, take this information given the context that you already know, and it also encourages us to be explicit about what our state of knowledge is and what our biases might be, instead of pretending that we can just kind of look at everything like we're performing a perfect experiment on it, but be sealed off from the real-world implication.
All right. So before you draw a conclusion from somebody's economic model of a financial product or a poll or a player's, you know, ball-to-strike ratio, you have to think carefully about what you think you know and ask, does this make sense?
And this is especially true in cases where we have limited information. So, for example, in baseball, you have so much data where you have 750 players every year, and we've played Major League Baseball for about 150 years now, where in baseball you almost can just run a pure statistical model and take the result out and be satisfied that's a pretty good representation of the truth. But in other fields, like presidential elections, for example, we've only had 16 elections since World War II. This is the 17th, I believe. So we don't really know all that much based on why people vote the way they do or exactly which economic indicators are most important. And so we have to make some educated guesses. And those guesses are based on the historical evidence that we do have, but also based on theory and what might even be called common sense for example, and on having good structural variables in the model. For example, saying that, yeah, we probably should weigh the economy some, but we're going to look at a number of different economic data series because we're not sure exactly what's most important to people. So I think people who are working both in a casual way and in a technical way in these fields don't always respect how important it is for how much quality information do you have, whereas baseball is at one end of the spectrum. We have so much data, you can be really data-driven, and something like politics or maybe a new type of financial instrument is at the other end, where we've never seen how mortgage-backed securities performed in the long term. So you can't be guided that much by the history alone, and you have to think sensibly about these things and be more of a Bayesian, as it would be called.
And you're right, there are some people that do this. And you cite the chief economist at Goldman Sachs, a guy named Jan Hatzius. Am I pronouncing that right?
I think it's Jan Hatzius.
Who wrote a paper in November 2007 that was strikingly accurate, predicting not just what would happen with mortgage-backed securities, but their broader effect on the economy. What did he get that others didn't?
So what he understood is he put two different puzzle pieces together. Number one, he realized that these instruments were very risky because of the potential for a housing price collapse. They weren't robust to the possibility of a housing price decline. But number two, he realized how large a fraction of the economy this had become. So for every actual dollar that Americans spent on a new home during the bubble, there were about $50 of side bets. These derivatives and securities were being traded very, very rapidly. It represented a extremely large chunk of the financial sector. And when all of a sudden trillions of dollars of what people think are profits turn out to be a mirage, that creates a gigantic hole in the economy. And that takes a long time to repair. Where you're not quite sure who owes what to whom, and you have to untangle and unwind everything. And very often when you have recessions that are triggered by financial crises, they do perpetuate for years and years and years. In some ways, the American experience since 2007 is quite typical, where finally in 2012, you maybe see more resilient signs of a recovery in the job market, but still not great, and it's taken an awful long time to get here.
You'd write that there are some fields that have managed to make better use of all this explosion of data than others. Weather forecasters, for example, is it that they understand this Bayesian principle that you have to think carefully about what it all means?
So the weather forecasters, I think, are Bayesian in the sense that they're frequently updating their forecasts. Another big Bayesian idea is that you always want to make the best forecast that you can at the time you're making the forecast. There's no glory in sticking to a forecast you made 3 days ago when the facts change. But the weather forecasters also do a couple of other things. One of the most important ones is thinking probabilistically. By the way, that's another component of Bayes' theorem, is that the number, you think of everything in terms of a probability. So there's a 60% chance that Obama will be reelected, there's a 2% chance that we'll find life on Mars, and so forth. It is framed in terms of a probability rather than a certainty either way. But weather forecasters really realized very early on, because of something called chaos theory, that they could never make perfect predictions, that as smart as they are and as good as our computing power is, it's still very small as compared to all the complexities of Mother Nature, how a cloud forms or something like that, or a rainstorm develops. So they can get to better and better approximations. But when they tell you that there's a 30% chance of rain, people think, oh, that's being wishy-washy. Will it rain or not? I want to know. That just reflects a more honest view of mankind's predictive powers, that we can get close to the truth and kind of give you the odds almost as a gambler might, but we'll never know for sure. None of us are possessed of true clairvoyance. And lo and behold, in having for many, many years given those probabilistic estimates and thought about the weather that way, they've gotten a lot better. They aren't perfect by any means, but now when you have a hurricane, for example, sitting in the Gulf of Mexico, they can predict the landfall position of that hurricane within about 100 miles on average, 3 days in advance, which means if you need to evacuate some key counties in Louisiana or Mississippi, you could do so. 25 years ago, they could only get within about 250 miles on average. If you draw a radius, it would take you everywhere from about Tallahassee, Florida to Houston, Texas. Not a very useful prediction at all.
And are we talking about the National Weather Service or commercial forecasters, everybody?
So here is a slightly important distinction to make, where the data we've seen the most impressive gains is from the National Weather Service itself. They're scientists. They're very rigorous about what they do. This should maybe be distinguished from the local TV meteorologist who succumbs to various types of news media biases, where it's been shown, for example, that local meteorologists have what's called a wet bias, which means they put more rain in the forecast than there really is. So the idea that, oh, this guy's always talking about the next snowpocalypse or the next storm of the century, and it doesn't always seem to pan out. If you're watching the Weather Channel, that's not a fair complaint, but if you're watching the goofball on Channel 7, then that's actually true. They deliberately make the forecast worse because it gets better ratings and seems more dramatic to people.
Right. Now, one crew that you think does a particularly poor job of using data and forecasting are political pundits. And
yes.
I love this. You did a study of nearly 1,000 predictions by panelists on the McLaughlin Group. You found a quarter of the predictions were too vague to analyze, really. But among those that you could test, what did you find?
The predictions, and these were made over a 4-year interval, so it's a big enough chunk of data to make some fair conclusions. We found that almost exactly half of the predictions were right, and almost exactly half were wrong, meaning if you just flipped a coin instead of listening to these guys and girls, you would have done just as well. And it wasn't really even the case that the easier predictions turned out to be right more. So, for example, on the eve of the 2008 election, and you can go to Vegas, and you would have seen Obama with a 95% chance of winning. Our forecast model had him with a 98% chance. Three of the four panelists said it was too close to call, despite Obama being ahead and every single poll for months and months, and the economy having collapsed. One of them, actually, Monica Crowley of Fox News, said she thought McCain would win by half a point. Of course, what happened the next week, where she came back on the air and said, oh, Obama's win had been inevitable. How could he lose with this economy and so forth? And so there's not really a lot of accountability for these predictions. They're mostly meant as entertainment, and it's hoped that the viewer will forget about them just moments later.
Well, Nate Silver, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Nate Silver's new book is The Signal and the Noise. He also writes the 538 political blog on the New York Times website. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.